I think the point we're trying to hammer here is like it's important to look and really review what went well and what didn't go well.
Yeah.
And that transitions into what was your expected sales price versus your real sales price, right? I think that's one that a lot of people mess up. It's just as important as knowing what your contracting bill was going to be, right?
100%.
So our team looks and we say, what was our projected ARV? And this is why we say it's important to document that. And then what did we actually sell it for? You know, Waterford is a great example where we had a projected finished price at $575. We listed it at $599 and it sold for $620. Then we have another one on Casty that we thought was, you know, $475. We're at $450 right now and we haven't sold, right? So you have to also start paying attention. Which homes are we, you know, accurate on? Which types of homes are we usually under? And which types of homes do we usually go over? And you can learn to be more aggressive that way.
Welcome back to the Pursuit of Property podcast. Thank you guys for tuning in today. Today, we're going to wrap up part four of our mini series on the building blocks of your business. Up until this point in parts one through three, we are essentially at the point of your deal being sold, whether that was a wholesale deal, wholetail deal, a flip. Congratulations. At this point, your project is sold. And now it may seem like the work's all done, but there is a whole other aspect to a deal that comes after the sale and after the closing. My man, Scott, how are you doing today?
Damn, you jumped right into
it. I did, dude.
Locked in.
Ready to bring this info to the people today, dude. Come on now.
No, you're right. Money's in. I think a lot of people, the deal's done at that point, and our opinion is the deal is not done. There's still work. And you and I are both a little fried this morning mentally because we have been preparing to go over our quarter, our first quarter of the year, and all the deals that we did. And so we're living proof that we go through what we're preaching today, and we analyze what went well, what didn't go well, and kind of the after deal process that we're going to be talking about today.
Yeah, that's a great point because we obviously do have some best practices that we've been using for a long time in terms of post-deal, you know, best practices. But even yesterday, we've added something new that we'll talk about later on in terms of cash conversion cycle and lead conversion cycle that we are just starting to implement for our post-deal analysis and review. So I think that'll be really great info to bring all of you guys. So, Scott, I know we've both been in the position where we've had a huge freaking deal close, right? Whether that was a wholesale, wholetailer flip, and the money hits the account. What's the first thing that we do?
The very first thing that I do is move money for taxes. Don't forget, like, true story, when I first got in the business, I didn't realize how taxes were going to work. And I got to April and I owed $10,000 that I didn't have. So don't do that. The first thing we recommend is when you make a big chunk of money is to talk with your accountant and come up with a percentage of the money that you should put away for taxes. Now, that could be anywhere from 30% down to 15% or even less depending on your business. But the first step that we recommend is you move some money away because Uncle Sam's going to want his piece.
Yeah, exactly. Like you said, a good piece here, you guys, is obviously it's the nature of this business. You should have a solid relationship with a bookkeeper, a CPA, an accountant. They're going to be a really integral part of your team. But a good rule of thumb that we started out with, I think we were a little aggressive at that 30% number.
I still do that.
And I still do that 30% as well. So say, for example, right, you've just assigned a deal, it closed, your wholesale fee brought in $10,000. What Scott's saying is right off the top, when that hits your checking account, you have a separate savings account that's labeled tax account or taxes or something, and $3,000 of that $10,000 is immediately getting transferred to that account and left until the dreaded tax season comes around. But the reason for this, like you said, it helps you avoid that dreaded situation of, you know, Uncle Sam coming and knocking on your door asking for money when you don't have any set aside.
Right. And the other part to it is you can use some of that money to invest into your business if it's overage, right? So say you end up saving $50,000, but your tax liability ends up being $30,000. That extra $20,000 didn't get wasted on miscellaneous stuff. You had it saved. Now you can use it to lower your liability by investing in other stuff, right?
100%.
I think before you can even do that, though, something to note is a lot of people are going to think that the money, the wire that they get from escrow, is their profit. And that's not actually true, right?
Yeah, 100%.
So it's important to pay attention because, like, unlike a commission where the money that gets wired to you is your profit, typically, with a flip, you're going to get a big chunk of money back. And in there, there's going to be things that need to get paid off, right? So maybe you spent, I guess, maybe you spent money on cleaning the house, right? And you didn't pay attention to that. That's not going to be in your QuickBooks or in your marketing expense or your rehab. So you need to first go back to your whatever ledger you're using to track your expenses and start making sure that everything's there.
Yeah, every single thing being attributed. And even like you mentioned, even for agents, like a great point, right? Sometimes something that isn't even included in that wire, right, that you usually have to account for. Say you get a commission, the commission check hits for $10,000, you're thinking that's your profit. Well, rewind a little bit. You most likely had a sign installation fee to go get your listing sign installed.
$50.
Your photos, which can usually cost a couple hundred bucks. After the deal closes, which is an expense that should be attributed to that deal, is any client gifts that are then given to your clients, right? So having to make sure, like you said, keeping track of any and all expenses related to the deal in any sort of way. If it's something as minuscule as a cleaning, to listing photos, to whatever it is, to make sure that when you then go back, you can generate a true deal profit amount from that project or from that deal.
Yeah. So like we're saying, the very first step is to go. We recommend that you use something like QuickBooks, a professional software. But if you're not in that position, you can use an Excel sheet, which we've both done.
Yeah.
And it's important that week by week, you're taking taking account of anything that went towards that property. So yeah. Materials, checks to contractors, you know, break-ins or plywood, whatever you're putting, right? And as you go through that, at the end, you're going to have a total cost into the deal. And that's going to include interest payments, insurance costs, taxes, which keep an eye out for your supplemental tax bill that's going to be coming. At that point, you can start tallying it up and you'll have a better understanding of what your real profit looks like.
Yeah, and a couple last minute items that sometimes fly under the radar is that people can forget about, especially if the deal takes a long time, is any cash for keys that pay out for a tenant, right? Which can be a couple grand. That's not a small amount, right? So making sure you attribute any cash for keys cost as well is huge, and making sure that that's attributed as well. Now, for wholesales or assignments, right? Obviously a little bit more simple in the post-deal, you know, analysis than a flip or a wholetail when you're going to have a lot more expenses involved. When we talk about wholesales, yes, you can still have some cash for keys agreements, right? And another under the radar thing is typically, depending on what bank you have, you can have an incoming wire fee charge depending on if you're getting, you know, a wire coming in, which can be $20 or $30.
I didn't know that.
And same with outgoing wires, depending on the type of business account you have, can be another $20 to $30. So another fly under the radar charge there that should be attributed whenever you're sending or receiving money if you're getting charged through your bank.
Oh, EMD. For a wholesale.
EMD.
Right?
Exactly.
You may assign a deal for $10,000, but if you put in a $500 EMD, your wire is going to be $10,500.
Really good point.
So that's not $10,500 in profit. That's $10,000 in profit.
Because that $500 was already yours going in.
Yep.
Now, let's more focus on the rehabs now when we talk about either a flip or a wholesale, right? And you may or may not have a physical bid for a wholetail, right? Typically a wholetail, you're going in and you're doing very little work, right? You're cleaning out any trash inside or outside. You might spend a couple thousand if you're painting the exterior or interior, right? But very often you are not spending very much and may or may not even have a bid from a contractor for a wholetail. But for a flip, right? When we rewind and go back to episode two, when we're trying to collect bids, or episode three, thank you, trying to collect these bids from your contractors, you're doing your deal analysis, you should have that bid in front of you now that the deal's closed, right? So when you went to underwrite the deal with your contractor, they looked and said, hey, this is going to cost $60,000 to fix. And that includes X, Y, Z, A, B, C, blah, 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 the whole nine yards. Now, you should be able to look back. You've been keeping track of your expenses of your flip up until this point, whether it be in a free resource like a spreadsheet or in a QuickBooks. And the next step to do is compare those two numbers. Did you come in under budget? Did you come in over budget? Were you right on par with what the budget was estimating? And I think from that point, whether you came in under or came in over, the important thing to try and analyze is, where did you save money, or on what line items did you spend more money than anticipated?
Right. The only way that you can start building a business that's consistent is you start to underwrite deals that you completed so that future deals, you know what to expect.
Yeah.
So for us, we always look at it and we say, what was the initial bid that we signed with the contractor that we took for the deal? And then what did we end up spending and why was that, right? And every deal you're going to find, you saved on some areas and you were over on others. And then looking for those things that maybe the acquisitions person didn't catch, right? Did we end up doing an HVAC that we didn't budget for? Or were the window seals cracked and we didn't notice that when we walked the house to begin with? Or was there plumbing or electrical that we didn't budget for that had to get done? And the purpose of this is to help on the acquisition side have a finer eye for analyzing the deal so that we lock properties up for the right price to begin with.
Yeah, and I think another best practice too is when you're looking at what came in under, over, or right on par is what was a controllable versus an uncontrollable when those things happen, right? So for example, a controllable would be if you went in after the fact to make design changes, right? And you wanted to put in nicer finishes, like we said, you may be overdoing the house, right? So that was not to the fault of, you know, the contractor or an uncontrollable. If you're that decision maker, the reason you went over was because you went in and you overdid the house. Now, right. A potential uncontrollable, right? Because often, you know, as an investor, you may be purchasing properties as is, right? Probably not doing any inspections is, hey, we had to go in after the fact and we thought the plumbing was all good, but we had to then go in and repipe the entire house and cost us $15,000, $20,000 to do that, that we didn't think we were going to have to go in and do. While that was an uncontrollable, right, looking back to where, you know, you were purchasing as is and didn't do any inspections, kind of the learning lesson for maybe an uncontrollable cost like that would be, hey, either, you know, now if you're a little scarred from that deal, maybe potentially doing some sort of inspections just for your reference, or two, always try to buffer or build in a percentage for the uncontrollables like that, which we typically try and do too, because we know no matter how hard we try and prep, there is always going to be at least one thing that pops up once you're into that house uncovering all these things that was not going to be accounted for.
Yeah, a good example would be the house on Maywood, where the HVAC looked great and it looked new, so we didn't budget for it, but it turns out it was just a shell of an HVAC. It didn't work, right? That's kind of out of our control. We don't expect our sales team to walk through the house and turn on the HVAC and make sure it works, right?
Yeah.
They're not HVAC techs. You know, we hoped we could repair it, and I don't think we could we?
No.
Yeah, so we had to replace it, right? So that's a perfect example where you have to just learn from your mistakes, learning to ask those questions, and learning more about the property in that walkthrough than just what the eye sees.
Yeah.
Another example would be code enforcement, right? Liens. Like, we've definitely bought properties where we didn't realize there was code enforcement and then we had to deal with it, right? So that's another controllable. We could have looked into it and we need to learn from that mistake.
And on the topic of bills or expenses that can trickle in, you know, weeks or even months after the fact, and a good reminder for people is when you do sell a project, right, that you owned and utilities were in your name, when you sell that property, make sure utilities are no longer in your name. And good, you know, a good reference point is just know that sometimes there's still going to be a little buffer from when you sell the property to where, you know, this miscellaneous PG&E bill or water bill or sewage bill can still trickle in months or weeks or even months after the fact, and making sure those are properly accounted for, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, you may be able to generate this true profit number semi-quickly, but just always make sure that that's being updated if any of these miscellaneous bills for utilities, stuff like that, come in after the fact.
Yeah. I think the point we're trying to hammer here is, like, it's important to look and really review what went well and what didn't go well.
Yeah.
And that transitions into what was your expected sales price versus your real sales price, right? I think that's one that a lot of people mess up. It's just as important as knowing what your contracting bill was going to be, right?
100%.
So our team looks and we say, what was our projected ARV? And this is why we say it's important to document that. And then what did we actually sell it for? You know, Waterford is a great example where we had a projected finished price at $575. We listed it at $599 and it sold for $620. Then we have another one on Casty that we thought was, you know, $475. We're at $450 right now and we haven't sold, right? So you have to also start paying attention. Which homes are we, you know, accurate on? Which types of homes are we usually under? And which types of homes do we usually go over? And you can learn to be more aggressive that way.
Yeah. And that last part, you make a great point. The whole reason for conglomerating all of this information is to be able to go back and help either your acquisitions team, or if you're in that seat as well, to help you in that. It helps you to be able to run and refine your numbers better. And it also gets you more familiar, like you said, with running comps versus what may be actual reality. Because a lot of us sometimes, especially as new investors, you know, we kind of create the number that we want to see in order to try and make our numbers work in order to get the deal done. But the purpose of getting all of this information together, this post-deal analysis, to be able to help you go buy better deals and the right deals. Because like you mentioned, sometimes with all of this, you learn what zip codes perform really well. You learn what neighborhoods perform really well or might be your bread and butter, right? So being able to conglomerate all this together and go do better deals.
Right. And it takes time. Like, you have to do a lot of these deals for this to become super helpful. Yeah. But it gives you confidence at the start. Say you've only done one deal and some parts went well and some parts didn't go well. Well, you're going to kind of be a little bit less confident if that deal didn't make as much as you hoped. And you may be overconfident if it made you more than you hoped, right? So it's important to see, well, why did it do that? So that going into the next seller's appointment, you have like a logical understanding of what happened previously for you. And then you have more confidence when you're talking to that seller and articulating why your price might be higher or lower than theirs.
Exactly. It adds credibility to where genuine credibility, right? To then you can bring that experience. You can bring the exact address. You can bring the exact financials to a seller and say, hey, this property around the corner or down the street or wherever it is, we just wrapped up with this, and here's really what we're seeing in terms of construction costs, rehab costs, that sort of a thing, to provide that credibility and help your negotiation 100%.
Yeah. And again, this is all to help build the confidence and create an actual business.
Yeah.
So the last thing I was going to say is the timeline of everything.
Yeah.
Because that's, I think, one of the things most people are wrong about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And talking about timeline, right? Because when we're in the bid process, your contractor might say, hey, based on this scope of work, it's going to cost this amount and we're going to be able to knock this thing out in 6 weeks, right? The deal closes, you wrap up and you realize, oh shit, this deal took 10 weeks. It didn't take 6 weeks. And this is where having that effective, not only paper trail, but check-in process throughout the project to better understand, okay, if you're now looking, this deal took 10 weeks. Originally, we were, you know, contractor said we were going to be done in 6. Why did this take 1 month longer than we were expecting? Is it because of some of these uncontrollables? Did we have to replace the pipes? Did the city have to come in because we got flagged for some permit stuff? Like, what happened here, and was it a controllable or uncontrollable as to why we went over or under our expected timeline?
Right. And again, it helps you kind of plan, when should I be expecting that money to come back, and how much should I budget for the cost of holding a house? Because each month you're paying property tax, mm-hmm. you're paying utilities, you're paying interest on whatever loan you're using. So it's important, because those, each day that goes by is going to be another 50 or 60 bucks that comes out of your profit. And sometimes it's within your control. That's what you're looking for. And sometimes it's not, and you just need to plan on it from the get-go.
Yeah. And the other point I was going to make here is, with your projects, whether they're wholesale, wholetail, flip, what the conglomeration of all of your projects, you need to have some sort of deal tracker where you are keeping track of the deals that you have completed and some of these key KPIs, right? One of which being the deal source. Always make sure post deal that you're attributing the deal to the right source. Did it come in through a referral? If so, who brought the referral? Did it come in from direct mail? If so, what marketing channel or what marketing list, excuse me, did it come from for mail, right? So having this living, breathing spreadsheet where you can go in and see your past deals and some of these key KPIs like profit and rehab expenses and stuff like that is going to be really key for you too, just to be able to keep track of all of these things on paper, share it with those who may need it, this, that, and the other.
Yeah, and refer back to it, right? You're going to come across a deal that may be similar to one you've already done. And you can quickly say, well, this house we bought for this price, fixed it up this much, sold it for this price, and made this much money. How does it compare to the house I'm looking at today?
Yeah.
And how does the market compare to that market? But we do that for all of our deals. And it's also interesting because then we can start making marketing decisions on which channels are really operating for us and where should we really be spending our time and effort, right? Because we'll come to find in some markets, one channel may make us a majority of our deals. And then 6 months later, it's a different channel. And we need to be able to kind of ebb and flow with whichever marketing stream is working.
Well, and not only that, that's a really great point too, but seeing, hey, okay, we may have done more deals with this marketing channel. Say we did 5 deals under this marketing channel and list, and we've made $100,000. But in this marketing channel and list, we've only closed 3 deals, but we've done $150,000, right? So you may have done more deals under a certain channel, but if you're not keeping track of what that profit number and expenses number are, numbers are, you won't be able to see things like that and say, hey, okay, maybe we should double down on this other channel because it's bringing us in more money with a comparatively a less amount of deals. So if we're able to bump up that number of deals, we should ideally be able to bring up our average number of profit as a company or as a business owner as a whole.
Right. And maybe we can jump into what we were working on yesterday and talk through that a little, because I think most investors should have that, which is it's a tracker that has a data set. Let's start with the data set because that's probably the easier portion.
Yep.
It has a list of all the properties that you've closed. So the first column is going to be the address. The second column is going to be the day that you first met that person, right? And we're getting that information so that we know how long did it take from when we first met Cade to when we closed and sold that deal.
Yeah.
And we're tracking that because it's important to know how long this takes, because sometimes as investors, we're impatient.
Mm-hmm.
Then we look, the next date we're tracking is when it got signed.
Yeah.
So when we met him to when it got signed, that way we can say, okay, it takes us on average, like we found out yesterday, 70% of our deals are sub 30 days from when we meet them to sign a contract. So it teaches our team, okay, in that first 30 days, we need to be on top of it. After that, then it goes into
the day that... If you're purchasing this, right, for a wholesale, you never own the property, but you're going to have that acquisition date of when escrow closes on your purchase, right? That way you can track if this is a project, you know, from the day that you closed. Again, this goes back to kind of your timeline numbers for rehab. The day you bought it, right, to another date you also keep track of is the day you sold it, right? The day escrow closes on the sale. So those 2 days or those 2 columns also being very important dates.
For how many days that you actually own that home.
Exactly.
Right. And so we're tracking that. We're tracking the profit margin, the marketing channel, which is the type, right? Cold calling, direct mail, referral, the list, right? And the reason we're tracking list is because we're marketing always to 18 different types of sellers and we want to know which one's performing.
Yeah.
And then after that, we have our lead conversion and our cash conversion.
Yeah.
Right? The lead conversion, and again, I feel like we're just kind of ranting right now, but we're still figuring it out ourselves. Lead conversion is we're trying to figure out based on the type of marketing channel, direct mail, cold call, referral, how long does it take for our team to lock up the deal?
Yeah.
And why would we want to know that?
Yeah, I mean, that's really helpful to know because if things are taking a really long time or if things are happening very, very quickly, it's a direct reflection of some of the systems and processes and techniques that you have in place as that acquisitions person or your team, right? So you shared the example that our acquisitions team of the 10 closed deals so far, 70% of those have come into our system and signed the contract in 30 days or less. To me, that tells me, damn, our sales team is on top of it. They're on top of it with follow-up. They're on top of it with communicating with the seller within that first 30 days. Now, if a lot of things are taking a lot longer, again, you'd have to read into a lot of the data, but it could potentially say, hey, maybe we need to be more effective with our follow-up procedures here, right? We need to be following up a little bit more often. Now, that's not always going to be the case. Sometimes leads just need a little extra follow-up because they're not ready to sell at the exact moment, right? But being able to say, hey, and this is when we talked about and utilized our new drip campaigns that we've put in to the CRM saying, hey, we don't want anything to fall through the cracks. We want to be able to utilize and sign every possible deal we can. Let's make sure our follow-up and our drips for touching these leads is dialed in so that we know anytime that lead's ideal or prime time to sell is, we're there on that day at that time getting that inked on that ideal day.
Right. So we're tracking kind of how long it's taking us to lock up contracts. That's going to help you understand more about how you need to approach the leads you're marketing to. And then the last thing we're checking is cash conversion cycle, which is essentially how long it takes us to do the deal.
Yeah.
And that's our acquisitions team knows what to budget for. But also when you start doing flips, you start realizing you can get into a cash crunch.
Yeah.
Right? Interest payments, insurance. There's so many different monthly costs that you have to pay. Even if that deal makes you $100,000, you still need to pay those before you get your $100,000, right? And it gives our team the ability to start predicting when that money is going to come back so that we can better be prepared when we're locking up a new deal to have the cash for it.
Yeah. Let's talk about, unless you have any other lingering thoughts, talk about what a lot of people now, right, is what do you do with the rest of the money? At Lambo. This point, if Our previous guest and our buddy Jace Bieber, you go out and buy, what do you buy, a Mercedes?
A Mercedes.
Yeah, right off the bat. Go and buy a new Mercedes off the lot. You won't regret it. So if you followed the best practices up until this point, right, the money's come in, you've immediately transferred and put some away for taxes, you've taken care of any last other miscellaneous bills that have come in, right? What do you do with the overflow? Say you made $50,000. You put away X amount for taxes. You had a couple other bills come in. What do you do with the remaining amount?
Well, I guess this is where we're going to kind of talk about our personal preference, but
there's a lot of different ways to do it.
Yeah. My opinion is at this point, you should have multiple bank accounts.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because if you have a whole bunch of money in one account, you're going to be looser with that money than if you have it broken out and budgeted.
Yeah.
So the way I would have recommended is that you have an owner's reserves account, you have an operating account, and a taxes account at a bare minimum. And I would also have a marketing account. So right off the bat, you get $50,000 in. 30% of $50,000 is $15,000.
Yes.
$15,000 goes into your tax. So you're down to $35,000.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, you need to think about how much is your marketing budget for each month. And you want to be thinking about what you're doing to prepare your business for a recession or a rainy day, right? So our recommendation is, if you haven't gotten your owner's reserves account to 6 months of savings, probably prioritize getting that saved up.
Yeah.
So put a chunk of your money towards your owner's reserves, and the rest should go into marketing and operating, meaning the money going into your marketing account is so that you can continue to push out more marketing to get more phone calls, to get more leads and more deals. And the operating account is what maybe pays your salary or what you live off of, and then pays for your office or your car, whatever tools allow you to capitalize on your marketing.
Yeah, 100%. I know in my experience too, we've both followed a very similar approach. I know we know people, there's, I don't even know fully how it works, but there's like the profit first book or method that I know some people use. Again, at this point, it's really just personal preference, and you'll learn, you'll sink or swim pretty quick and know if something's working for you or not based on your system. But yeah, I think all of those great points being making sure your taxes are taken care of, your owner's reserves is continually being filled. If it is already filled at that 6 months, then putting more, potentially putting more in towards marketing, and then also making sure you have enough in that operating account to keep the lights on and the money going for the next month.
Right.
So, yeah,
that's a super, super fast way of breaking it down.
100%.
But we've done podcasts, I think, about creating those banks.
And we've had, actually, when we, you mentioned a great, kind of having those bare minimum three accounts. We've had our buddy Arion come on.
Garavesh, yeah.
Who is an absolute stud. And we've had him on at least once, probably twice, and have broken down how to run your financials in your business. Those episodes, really, really good resources for you guys. And he's a great guy to know and to network with.
Yeah. So, okay, you've moved your money into your different accounts. The next thing is to start finding your next deal.
Yeah.
While you're flipping your first deal. This is, I think, the mistake a lot of people make. And we didn't talk about it in the last episode because we had a lot to cover.
Yeah.
But while you're managing your flip, while you're in escrow, while you're selling your flip, you need to be finding the next deal to close on. And this is part of being an investor. These are transactions. These are not passive income. So it's all great until the music stops because you weren't finding your next deal. So during this whole process, you should be locking up more deals, and or if there's no deals to buy that make sense, looking for investments you can park money in that bring in cash flow to get off the wheel.
Yeah, I think in this, we've talked about it in plenty of podcasts too, and it's very similar approach to like follow up, right? Like you can't stop lead generating just because you're having this great conversation with the lead. If you're spending all your time spinning your wheels talking to this lead, or spending your time with the escrow process, or trying to do all these other things at once, and that faucet turns off and there's no leads coming in, we know that depending on how long that faucet's off, to turn it back on, it's another delay of at least potentially 2 to 6 months for that lead flow to start trickling back in, right? So it's a lot harder to turn that faucet back on if you make the mistake of turning it off instead of just keeping it running and flowing.
And it's like what we said in the first episode. It's not going to be a business if you don't have leads coming in and people to talk to. So be very conscientious as you're through this whole process to keep marketing consistently and keep doing lead generating activities to bring in new opportunities, right?
Yeah.
If you don't, you're going to experience the big wave that you and I have both experienced, where you have two or three deals, then nothing, then two or three deals, then nothing. And the only way you go from that to where we're at now, where we have 29 projects in different stages, is you have to constantly, I mean, there's still ups and downs, but getting to the point where you can manage two or three while lead generating, and then manage three or four while lead generating, and then you're signing 10 deals while lead generating, right? That's the only way you grow the business past this, you know, one or two deals a year situation.
That's it. And we were just talking about this to somebody, or it may have been in one of the recent episodes, where a lot of people are very eager, right? Of course, all of us want 10 deals going on, right? But you can't get to the point of being able to handle 10 deals until you know how to handle your first one, right? And that goes for both agents and investors, right? You'd be very eager to try and have 5 escrows going on, but you can't make the jump from 0 to 5 without first having 1, without then going to 2. Exactly like you were saying, you need to become the type of business owner, the type of agent, the type of investor who can handle that type of deals before just having them all thrown into your lap, right? So be patient, essentially, is the message there. And not being able to get impatient or beating yourself up if you're not at the point of having 10 deals. You need to be able to figure out how to handle one first.
Clip.
Bang.
Boom. That's going on social media right there. You're right. We talked about that. Like, if you were given, and I was told this as well, if you were given 5 escrows at the start of your career, you would fumble all of them because you aren't the person that can handle it. And I think going through the system that we're talking about for this series, we're giving you the best practices so that you get one done and you don't mess up and then you have to restart and learn how to do one again. We're trying to shortcut that timeline, right? We are doing tons of deals at a time and we're trying to do every single one of these steps. We're trying to keep consistent marketing out. We're then doing consistently generating deal review appointments, offers, and contracts. Then we're getting consistent contractor bids and comparing them to what our estimates were. Then we're getting closed and we're watching how long each flip's taking us, right? And at the end, like we mentioned, on Friday, we're going to look at how our quarter went and we're going to analyze. How did we do? How was this deal compared to what we thought versus what actually happened? And we're going to focus on the losers. We're not going to focus on the winners because the winners are great. But what were the deals where maybe things went really wrong so we don't make those mistakes again?
Yeah. Yeah, reflecting on these past 4 episodes, dude, I mean, the goal here, like the whole title of this mini series was the building blocks of your business, right? And the whole reason for this is to be able to lay that foundation, right? Throughout all the information across these 4 episodes, lay that foundation to be able to then build that mansion on top of it, right? And obviously, we're at the point. How many team members? How many members do we have in our team? 11 team members, right? To be able to have 29 projects going on at once, you cannot do it alone, right? And so the earlier on in your investing career or your agent career or your real estate career that you're able to put these building blocks into place, that you're able to pour this solid foundation into place, it makes it a lot easier to when you are growing, your business is growing, and you need to add on and you need to delegate, it makes it a lot easier when all of these systems, all of these best practices are in place. It makes the jump of growing and taking on more projects a lot better than if you're just running around with your tail cut off, not knowing what you're doing, especially as a newer investor or a newer agent.
And we're both guilty of that. Yeah. And so hopefully you're learning from our mistakes because it's taken us 6 and 7 years to get to this point.
Yeah.
And we're still complete idiots. We're learning, right? And so I guess the only other things that we didn't mention after that deal is probably use some of that money to educate yourself.
Absolutely.
Put yourself in a room with other investors doing more than you, because sometimes paying to get the shortcut is better than trying to learn it the hard way.
Exactly. Or trying to do it yourself. And not to drag this on too much, but that's a perfect example of the drip campaigns. If you guys follow Scott on social media, you gave a whole breakdown of how we've utilized those drip campaigns. That was an investment of $2,000 to have someone copy and paste a proven known system into our business instead of trying to spin our wheels and have someone on our team do it ourselves, right?
Right.
You do not need to reinvent the wheel. Find the reputable people, right? That's the big part, to connect with, to network with, who can help maybe insert some of those building blocks into your business. Go educate yourself, right? Do not become stagnant and think that you're the shit just because you close a big deal, right? Go and educate yourself. Go and put yourself in a position to grow and actually build a business out of this thing. Not a hobby, not a side hustle. Build a business.
That's it. That wraps it up on what you do after a deal.
That's it. Dude, Now, dude, this was a big part of the past month or so, right? These four episodes, I know we had a couple guests come on in between to help reinforce some of the things we've been talking about. I think now it's time for us to go back to the drawing board, see what we can come back and talk about, see what badass guests that we can have come on and share some info with you guys. So thank you for tuning in to this mini series. We will keep you guys posted. We'll be back next week with another solid episode of the Pursuit of Property podcast. Thanks, guys.